Okay, should we start in? Seems awfully early for us to start at Libri, only 5 minutes late. But we can always take these risks. Welcome. It's great to have you here for this talk and this sort of series of things we're doing this weekend. Each term we are doing one sort of weekend seminar, which we did a couple last autumn and last winter, and were last winter and spring, and they went really well. And so we're carrying on. So there'll be this lecture tonight, and then again tomorrow morning with a long discussion after it, and then after lunch, the third lecture in this series. So before I introduce that, I'll just say a word about what's coming after that, which is next weekend, next Friday, October 14th, Joshua Chestnut is doing fasting. He did a lecture last year about fasting, and it was very, very interesting, and he's pulled more things together, and a very interesting take on fasting and its applicability to the world today. The 21st, special lecture and concert, musical devotion during the Counter-Reformation. Now that's by Rachel Kurtahara and her friends. She's a PhD in musicology, I guess. Is that right, Ben, at BU? And has done some things here before to us with her friends, who are also very, very able musicians. So that would be very interesting and fun to hear. And then on the 28th, I won't go through the whole term, but there's a lecture I've been waiting for a long time. Walter Kim from Park Street Church is doing a lecture that I've been bugging him about for a long time, which is basically, is the Old Testament God of smiting the same as the New Testament God of love? That was the very common misconception that there's a completely different God in the Old Testament than in the New. And I always try and get someone who really knows the Old Testament to take on that question. And he's done a PhD in Old Testament, so I think he'll do a great job on that. So, back to tonight. I've done it various times over many years, actually, because I felt it was such an important issue. Different lectures on tolerance. And I've wanted to put them together in a coherent sequence in a way that I've never done before. It's not exactly the same lectures, but they're putting together some sort of a coherent progression, because there's so much there. The history of, and I'm talking about religious tolerance here, or tolerance of religion, it has such a history, painful history, agonizing history, wonderful history, but presents us all sorts of very specific issues today and challenges today, at least as I've understood them. So I'll put these will be three lectures in a sequence. I hope you can all make it tomorrow. And if you can't, I guess it'll be up on the podcast in some way eventually. So to start in, tolerance. It's a very important issue today. I find Christians who are tolerant, kind, nice, wonderful people are getting beaten on the head for being intolerant, and they don't often know quite why, and seem a bit bewildered by that. And I can totally understand why, and that's part of what I'm trying to get at tonight. It's a word that's changing, and that's the whole theme that I'm doing here, which is a word in transition. And we're caught in the crossfires of that transition, I think, those of us here who are Christians. And that can get very confusing. deep impact on where the Christian is with respect to the society around us. I'll just start with a quote from a guy called Daniel Taylor. Some of you are familiar with him. He's written a book called Is God Intolerant? He captures something of the confusion by saying, talking about intolerance, and he claims intolerance is the only serious sin left in the world today. No other sins are sins. Intolerance is the only sin that really counts. And he says, America is sick of intolerant people, and it's not going to tolerate them anymore. He's suggesting some of the confusion that's brewing here, and because it really has hit us hard, and from an angle we're not used to. As he's suggesting, the topic gets heated, the rhetoric gets sharp. Some of that confusion is coming from the way the word tolerance has changed, meaning something different from what it has meant before. In these three lectures, tonight is going to be about original tolerance. That's sort of a little bit arrogant to talk about original tolerance as if I had access to some. But the way it used to be used is all I'm really saying. The way it used to be used as religious tolerance has been discussed for several hundred years now. And I'm going to look at that part of it rather than what I'm calling the new tolerance. I'll give you a few sort of hints about the new tolerance toward the end of this talk. A little bit at the beginning and then some more at the end. So this will be about the original meaning of tolerance. Tomorrow morning at 9:30 or whatever time we've got announced, I'll be talking about the new tolerance, the new meaning of the word, which is almost that tolerance is the only truth left. The tolerance is the only thing we can rely on. The only thing we know is really solid to count on as a moral value. I completely disagree with that statement, but that's what the lecture is going to be about. And finally, the third one, which will be tomorrow afternoon, is going to be, okay, what does it mean for us to actually be tolerant ourselves? And how does that work? Because I think we would probably get into a lot less battles over tolerance if we were really more tolerant ourselves, the way we handle our discussions and our attitudes and the way we live. So we're not guilt-free in this at all. I think we've got a huge amount to grow. Oh, to start in, the word tolerance comes from the Latin, as a lot of our words do. Tolerare, it means to endure or bear. Meaning to bear or endure something that's different and specifically objectionable or painful to you, but you bear it. The need for tolerance in general is pretty clear. People are different from each other. Some of their differences are experienced as obnoxious and irritating and objectionable to each other. We have to learn to bear with each other, be tolerant of each other, in order to not hurt each other or kill each other, which we do quite a lot, in fact, and have done quite a lot. So it's quite a serious thing. Our race got off to a bad start. Just think of the first two brothers, Cain and Abel. One murdered and the other murderer. A tragic testimony to the human need for conflict resolution, for being able to deal with difference between me and you, me and somebody else, you and somebody else, the need for tolerance. All civil societies contain, in law and in practice, both tolerance and intolerance, because both have their place. The big questions are where to draw the line between one and the other, tolerance and intolerance, and why. For example, in the United States, we do not tolerate murder or stealing, and we think that's for pretty good reasons. Both tolerance and intolerance can be a vice or a virtue, depending on where the line is drawn between them and why the line is drawn. Nazis were tolerant of the genocide of Jewish people, which made them intolerant of German people who expressed even sympathy for Jewish people. So just as an example of how to get the whole thing backwards. Because it has been done. It's been done much too much, getting it completely backwards. when it comes to religious toleration, all that means is allowing, permitting people to have the religious beliefs and practices that they choose. Even though they may be different from your own or different from the majority opinion or religious observance. Ideas and observance. I allow that, we allow that or permit that to people as opposed to coercing them to obey what we think religion ought to be and how it ought to be practiced, and to back that up by the coercive power of the state or of social exclusion or rejection, of hatred, of whatever, because there's different levels here. There's been a huge, I mean, particularly going back some years in European history, a huge dynamic of making sure that religious belief in any one area was uniform, and people were doing the same thing, worshiping the same God in the same way, and it was all enforced. Now, there are three kinds of religious tolerance, which are important to separate in our minds. First, there's what you could call legal tolerance, tolerance for the free practice of religious differences within anyone's political arrangement, within any one state, government, whatever. So this is the political freedom to have religious difference. That's an extremely important one, over which has been enormous amounts of battles. That's what I would call legal tolerance. Then, also very important, is personal or social tolerance. Even if there is legal tolerance, you can be nasty to people who don't believe what you believe. People have probably been nasty to you for believing what you believe, even though you live in the United States of America, where there is official legal tolerance. So personal and social tolerance means treating people of different religions and convictions from our own with respect, as equals, and at least as potentially as friends. Now, notice that both of these things, both the legal and the personal tolerance, have to do with how you treat persons, how you treat other people in their differences. These two together make up what I'm calling original tolerance. What I mean, I've talked about original tolerance. This is what original tolerance was about: legal and personal. And that's what was on both ends very, very controversial. The third kind of tolerance is this is more what I'm calling the new tolerance. It's really worldview tolerance, tolerance of ideas and actions, accepting other people's ideas and actions as equal in truth and value to your own. Okay? This is not so much how you treat persons, but what your attitude is to their ideas, their convictions, their behavior, whatever. Do you approve or celebrate what people do in diverse cultures, what they believe, their ideas, their behavior? And this is more what is called, what I'm calling the new tolerance. Not just me, it's what all sorts of people would call the new tolerance. The focus isn't so much on persons, it's more on what is believed and being accepting or even celebrating that. I'll not try to get into the new tolerance in this lecture, but it'd be helpful to just briefly contrast that to articulate what I've just said again. Original tolerance is putting up with what's objectionable in persons and to treat those persons with respect. The new tolerance is affirming or celebrating what is diverse in their culture, their ideas, their practices, and celebrating both that diversity. Okay.
We have an outline here,
which I hope most of you can see if I retreat back into a cubbyhole here. Um, Just a brief history of tolerance, and this is going to be very brief and sketchy. So I'm not trying to do really systematic and full here at all. Go back to the New Testament church. In the light of the three kinds of tolerance that I've mentioned, I'll be very brief here. In terms of legal tolerance, the church was so numerically insignificant and politically insignificant that it wasn't a position to have to deal politically with its attitude to difference. It was getting dealt unto politically on the receiving end of persecutions, from the Jewish state and religious establishment, and then later from Rome. So they had pragmatic reasons for wanting religious tolerance from the major power, Rome, which really kicked in by the year 50 on. There was really a major problem with Roman persecution. And you see this going through the book of Acts even. But they also had principled reasons for religious tolerance that you see coming up all through the New Testament. I'm thinking just the teaching of Jesus and Paul. Because of people are made in God's image with human dignity, the gospel was to be spread through persuasion and example, never ever by force. You have no suggestion in the New Testament, the teaching of Jesus, Paul, Peter, James, anyone else, that this message was to be spread by forcing people to believe it. Faith could not be coerced. The picture you get in the New Testament is faith that is coerced isn't faith. So we're not interested in that. It's not to say that Christians have never used force. I'm saying in the Scriptures, in the New Testament itself, this was not. It wouldn't have crossed their minds. Social tolerance. You think of Jesus' ministry, hanging out with all the dropouts, down-and-outs, rejects of Jewish society, and also eating with the leaders of the Pharisees, Sadducees, and some in the Roman hierarchy as well. He ate and drank just fine with everybody. He had no problem associating with anybody who would associate with him. Paul lived out the same kind of thing. Not just eating and drinking with them, but caring for them in very deep ways. He says in his letter to the Thessalonians, describing how he was with them before they were Christians, when he first gone there, we were gentle among you, like a nurse tenderly caring for her own children. This is not talking about Christians. This is talking about them before they were Christians, but this is how Paul was with them. He knew them. He knew them well. He cared for them. And you got the sense he's up late at night with them, dealing with problems they've got, dealing with their sick kids or whatever else is going on. Think of how Paul berated Peter in Galatians, the second chapter, when Peter withdrew and would not eat with Gentiles, only eat with Jews. Paul lets him have it here and tells him he's compromised the gospel itself because he's made the Jewish culture and Jewish identity to be a central part of what it is to be Christian. Paul says, absolutely not. We can't have lines drawn there, or people living as if they were, as if the line was drawn there. There was enormous social, personal tolerance, and certainly no hint of anything but legal tolerance. Was there anything like worldview tolerance or the new tolerance in the New Testament? You don't see anything remotely like it. I think of the Jesus' parting words, the Great Commission to his disciples, which was, go and make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I've commanded you. This was the command to the disciples to not accept and accept as sacred what all these people already believe now, but challenge it with the gospel of Jesus Christ. we have a sense today that what someone may believe, especially if it's connected to some native culture, is somehow sacred. No one should ever try to jar that loose. Jesus didn't know that. And Jesus was saying, go to all the nations and send and spread the gospel. Not by force, not by browbeating people, but by telling people good news. This is a challenge to everybody's religious ideas, was the good news of Christ. Early in late medieval church, at various stages in the first 300 years, there was severe persecution from Rome. And it's on and off, and various different persecutions of different emperors with different results. During which time, the church actually grew phenomenally, amazingly. Too long a story to tell, but Marty's done some lecturing on this. The problem was not that they worshipped Christ, and this bothered the Romans. The problem was that because they worshipped Christ, they would not worship the emperor, and that was a problem to the Romans. So their problem was, and from Roman perspective, was not being inclusive enough. Rome would have let them worship Jesus, no problem, but you've also got to worship Caesar and the Roman gods. Otherwise, you're not a part of this wonderful Roman project, and you actually, the Romans later on blamed Christians for, as the Roman Empire was disintegrating, as it's the Christians' fault because they're not worshiping the gods, the Roman gods, because the gods are getting even with us. So all that was loaded on Christians. But it wasn't for worshiping Christ, it was for their refusal to be inclusive, since they worship Christ, to everything else. By the late second century, Tertullian wrote, this is a wonderful statement, "It is a human law and a natural right that one should worship whatever he intends. The religious practice of one person neither harms or helps another. It is no part of religion to coerce religious practice, for it is by free choice, not coercion, that we should be led to religion." So there's Tertullian in the second century. Parts of it sound a little bit like Thomas Jefferson, actually. Not all of it. this great emphasis on freedom. People have to be free to choose. They've got their own mind. They have to be free to choose what they believe is really right. You can't coerce religious practice. Again, the principle of tolerance, freedom, non-coercion. After Constantine, who was a Christian emperor, who was the first to make the Christian faith legal, he didn't establish it as the official religion. That was done later. But his becoming emperor was a huge shift for Christians, after which they had a whole new range of temptations because they had greater access to political power than they had ever had before. And that's always a dangerous thing. Can be a great thing, but can be also a dangerous thing. In the 4th and early 5th centuries, you see someone like Augustine, or the great Augustine of Hippo, trying to bring unity to the church, trying to bring the Donatists into the fold, which they didn't seem to want to do, and he used force and made it clear that he was using force. And because of his stature, because of his authority, him doing this was influenced the rest of the church, or the rest of the Western church, in a very unhelpful way. To sort of give permission. But say by 591 AD, this is 6th century, Gregory the Great wrote to bishops in France. We thought we're using coercion, and he was criticizing for them using coercion. He says they should rather rely on the sweetness of preaching. That's a lovely term. People don't usually call preaching sweet today, but a great thing that he did: rely on the sweetness of preaching to spread this gospel, not your muscle, not your sword, not your cavalry or whatever. Through the Middle Ages, you get an such a mixed up and very, very difficult history to untangle. Serious anti-Semitism. It was worse for Jewish people after Constantine than it had been before. All sorts of, as the church grew in power and authority in the 11th and 12th century, with enormous control, the church had a legal system itself, it had a police force, it had armies, the Pope had armies. And there, obviously, there were crusades led mainly against Islam. There was an Inquisition to force orthodoxy within the church. That wasn't so much as much for people outside. King Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain, who were patrons of Columbus, as we experienced do Columbus Day on Monday, they were majorly behind the Spanish Inquisition. They were the main forces behind it, and which was run mainly by the Spanish crown, more so than by the Pope. The Pope was actually not all that excited about the Inquisition, but they carried it on for... They really got it rolling. You see the great schism of the church in about the year 1000, when the church separated, the Eastern Church separated from the Western Church, becoming what we now call the Eastern Orthodox Church from the Western Catholic Church based in Rome. That was, I think, a very sad split, division, but it was not something that how do we get along with these people who disagree with this wasn't such a problem, because there was a separation between East and West. Because there was a huge, perhaps even greater separation linguistically. In the East they spoke Greek, in the West they spoke Latin. And, for example, many of the people in the East for hundreds of years had never read Augustine, which would have been unthinkable in the West, because he's had such a massive influence on the church in the West. But, you know, he wasn't translated into Greek, so nobody read it. So, though the church was divided, they weren't dealing with the problem of diversity and how to live with people that we disagree with, until round about 1517, which is the Reformation, which is Luther's 99 Theses. And when the Reformation happened, and Protestant and Catholic were really forming different churches, you have people living side by side, city by city, who really believe something quite different, who worship in a different church, who disbelieve the doctrines of the people sitting living next to them, and so you have a real personal conflict there between them. You have a time which is called, very often called, the religious wars, from the mid 1500s to 1648. I don't like the, and I've given about four lectures on this a couple of years ago on religion and violence. I don't like the idea of calling these the religious wars, because religion was used, but probably a far greater impetus to the wars was, this was the time when the nations of Europe were being born and untangling themselves from these massive dynasties, like the Habsburg dynasty and the Bourbon dynasty and so on in France, and each one wanting desperately to be the new Rome, which means we'll run the whole schmear. We'll own everything. And so each one wanting to run the whole thing. And so you have these collisions between these dynasties, as well as all the little dudes and their little knights and city-states and so on, each one wanting to get their piece of the pie. And so having their own little battles and grabbing land. And so you have a chaotic political situation, local kings and knights and princes all trying to get a bigger piece of the pie. So actually some historians would say the religious wars would have happened even had there been no Protestant Reformation. In other words, even had there not been any religious division, they would have happened. Now, what would have happened is a judgment that's very hard to you know, to say with reliability. But it's really a distortion to call these the religious or the wars of religion and blame it all on Protestant Catholic. Although there was huge tension between Protestant and Catholic, a lot of the lines were, but plenty of the lines were drawn as, in terms of the battles in this period of time, as Catholic fighting Catholic. Charles V, the great Habsburg emperor, in about early 1520s, when the Reformation was just rolling in Germany, went to war. He didn't go north to fight the nasty Lutherans to put them down. He went south to fight the Pope's armies because the Pope was pinching some of his land near Rome. So, you know, I just throw this out because it's really a mistake to draw lines on between Protestant and Catholic in a firm way. Most of the soldiers were mercenaries, and they were ever switching sides between one and the other, depending on who was seen to be winning or paying the most money to them. So, but having said that, from 1550 to 1648, you have this chaotic period with enormous amount of fighting going on, and eventually some of the lines being formed that are now modern Europe. Theologically, the real differences that did take place is that Lutheran and Calvinist Protestants had an identity and were accepted as a group of people with land or who had different areas that were their territories. The Roman Catholic Church, after the Council of Trent, which was 1545 to 63, really reshaped much of its theology in opposition to Protestantism, so you have sharper lines drawn than had been drawn before. The Peace of Augsburg in 1555 didn't do very much, but they came up with the motto of "Who rules his religion?" And that meant whoever rules, whoever the prince is or whoever the king is, gets to decide what religion is going to be the religion of that area. So religion was still under the king or under the ruler, and it was only one religion in one under one political entity. But Protestantism was identified and was given the space of actually being having existence, as opposed to just being a protest group within the Catholic Church or something like this. And they had all sorts of things worked out. So if Catholic families lived within a place that was Lutheran, they were given a certain amount of time to leave before somehow Lutheranism would be forced on them. So this is a start. I'm trying to put a positive spin on this. This is at least a start in the right direction, in the sense of admitting and including religious diversity, including a space for religious diversity. That's what it does, rather than simply trying to crush religious diversity by armies. Peace of Westphalia, 1648, was able to be more effective, not because there was religious resolution, but because through that the different warring tribes reached some place of willing to stop fighting, because who rules his religion doesn't stop the warring if the princes are warring with each other, and the rulers began to get to be settled with the lines they had of land. At Westphalia, the greater political resolution made that motto more effective. Lutheranism and Calvinism were both given legal status. Holland got independence from Spain, and in its reformed, as in Calvinist sections, allowed more freedom for Jewish people than anywhere else in Europe. Interesting, under Calvin, you have more freedom for Jewish people, more space. In England, there's the Civil War in England in the 1640s, Parliamentary Revolution or the Puritan Revolution, and then the Glorious Revolution in 1688 and 9, which was a resolution of ideas that had never quite gotten ironed out after the Civil War. And in 89, there was what was called the Act of Tolerance. This was under the King and Queen William and Mary, who most of us have probably heard of, at least heard of the college named after them. And it allowed for much more freedom of worship for Protestants in general in England. No freedom for Roman Catholics in England at this point, so this was, England had swung to Protestantism. But the radical thing was that there was room for Baptists and Congregationalists in England. You didn't have to just be Church of England. Baptists and Congregationalists would have space as well. No room for Catholics, for atheists, for non-Trinitarians. So you can see where they draw lines. It's important to see where they draw lines. Across the pond, on our side of the pond, the colony of Maryland started as a Catholic colony. The Calvert family was a Catholic family. And they issued an act of toleration in 1649, making it okay, of course, to be a Catholic, but okay also to be any kind of a Trinitarian believer in Christ. As long as you believed in the Trinity, you were okay. You could be a Baptist, a Presbyterian, an Episcopalian, or whatever. But it wasn't okay to not believe the Trinity. Earlier still, on this side right on our turf now, in the 1630s, Roger Williams got himself thrown out of Massachusetts. He was banished from the Congregational Massachusetts colony, went to Rhode Island to start the most sweeping form of religious toleration anywhere yet, on this side of the pond or anywhere else either. Because he wanted not just religious toleration, but religious toleration for everybody, and he also wanted separation of church and state. That is, he didn't want the state to have anything to do with religion, any authority to be brought on religious matters whatsoever. And that made him really radical. That's one of the reasons he got thrown out of Massachusetts. The state was allowed to rule only on civil, not religious matters. He wrote, "To compel belief is the rape of the soul." That's really, I think, a pretty good way to put it. To compel belief is rape of the soul. And that oceans of blood have been spilled by the attempts to command conformity in religion. I come out of this having some real respect for Roger Williams in some areas. I'll be throwing some sand in his gears a little bit later. But 1681, William Penn was given what is now just as a payoff from the king who had debts. His payoff was Delaware and Pennsylvania. hundreds of square miles. It's just hard to imagine what space, what land meant then to pay off a previous debt. He was a Quaker, set up a colony for which allowed a large measure of religious freedom also, and also early forms of tentative democratic government within the state. I give these examples to show the sort of agonizing, faltering progress of religious toleration. And it was tough going. It was hard going. It was against all sorts of resistance and against all sorts of reasons why it shouldn't happen. It can happen. It will create chaos if it happens. Nothing came easily or quickly. Okay, what are some of the motivations for or against, or rationale for and against religious tolerance? The reasons to oppose it, I've hinted at already, but I'll give you some examples. Religious toleration politically was seen by many early Protestants and Catholics as a terrible evil, a terrible risk and an evil. Thomas Shepard, who was a Puritan leader, he was actually the first chaplain of Harvard College. This puts him back in the 1630s. He said, "Religious toleration is the firstborn of all abominations." So you know what he thought. Nathaniel Ward, who was a pastor in Ipswich, Mass., and in England, went back and forth a few times, was against toleration very strongly. He wrote that anyone willing to tolerate any religion or discrepant way of religion besides his own, unless it be in matters merely indifferent, either doubts his own or is not sincere in it. Now, you see, if you tolerate other people believing something different, it either means, except if it's in really small stuff, you either doubt your own or you're not really sincere in your own beliefs. You're a hypocrite. So that's the only reason you could explain religious tolerance. And that was a strong argument. That's that argument that moved a lot of people. So tolerance is a badge of weak faith and general spinelessness. The other reason that it was opposed was that it seemed certain to everybody that no government could stand without a unified religious establishment behind it. They realized that the motivation behind religion was so powerful that if you've got a divided religious establishment underneath one political roof, you will just have an explosion. And it couldn't be done. And as you realize this, you realize, wow, the formation of the US of A was a daring endeavor. Amazing that they had the courage to do it. Well, I'll touch on that in a minute. It wasn't the courage, it was they didn't have a whole lot of choice. But the idea was that religious diversity would subvert any state, some religious interests would be pitted against the state. Christian reasons for religious tolerance, on the other hand. On the other side, you see some of the strong, this turbulent 17th century in England of the single civil war, the parliamentary civil war, and so on. You have some of the Puritan leaders arguing that religious tolerance is true, good, and the best thing for the church. If I was trying to do anything complete here, I would spend some time on Holland too, because their history with religious tolerance was very interesting. You know, the folks who ended up on the Mayflower had taken refuge in Holland because they knew they would be safe to not be persecuted there. So you see an atmosphere in Holland that is a different. There was a religious toleration there that would be worth studying on its own. Puritan Christians like John Milton argued against religious censorship of the press in favor of free expression in his work called Areopagitica. He argued that the truth is best served and will prevail if it's given free expression and not forced on anybody. I mean, we would seem to want to say duh, you know? And yet it wasn't duh at all. It was much the other way around. In this, he was joined by the great Puritan theologian John Owen, who held, this isn't a direct quote from him, but this was just sort of summary: the truth held in humility is solid enough so that it can stand up in debate. In fact, it stands up best on its own without support of political coercion. Truth demands tolerance. Tolerance serves truth. So you have someone like Owen, a strong voice, very, very articulate, brilliant man. A voice for religious tolerance. Anabaptists and Mennonites on the continent from the early days of the Reformation argued for religious toleration in principle, but also pragmatically, so that they would be allowed space by Lutherans. But it's you see smaller groups with both principled argument and pragmatic argument. The Enlightenment weighed in very strongly, and in many discussions, the Enlightenment gets full credit. If you think religious toleration is good, the Enlightenment is apt to get full credit for it, which is not at all the case. Enlightenment didn't invent the idea of religious toleration, but pushed it very hard, especially in the wake of the religious wars, or the wars of 1550 to 1648, following the Reformations. They criticized especially political power of the church, and so they're down very hard on church coercion, but were actually some of them. Here you can't talk about the Enlightenment. Enlightenment is a group of it's not even a group, but a movement brewing in the 17th century of wanting to be free from the authority of the church, the authority of the Bible, and put a huge amount of weight on experimental science as the way to move forward. It actually is enormously diverse, and it's very hard to summarize. But someone like Rabbi Jonathan Sacks points out some of these guys were, though they were terribly hard on the church for their church's lack of tolerance, were very strong strongly anti-Semitic. Someone like Voltaire, for example, was very, very, very strong anti-Semite. But the distinctive idea that comes out of the Enlightenment that did contribute something to our modern world was a necessary tension, and I'll be hitting this a number of ways, but it'd be good to you to really get a hold of it, between religious tolerance and confidence, between tolerance and Christian certainty. John Locke, who was a Christian but also an empiricist philosopher, held that because religious truth can't be justified with the same level of certainty as you can something scientific, something through a scientific experiment, because you can't have the same level of certainty, we shouldn't coerce belief because we can't be assured of it. We should have religious toleration and permit diversity because we really can't know in the same high level of certainty. A lot of Christians, of course, objected to this and said, what do you mean? We can have all sorts of levels, a high level of certainty without it having anything to do with science, or maybe a higher level than we have in science, certainly in science. But soon, those who followed came, and this was more of the Enlightenment doctrines, we can't know with certainty anything about God at all. How can we know about God? We don't have any way of really knowing about God for sure. Therefore, we can't force others to comply as if we did, as if we were certain. So religious tolerance was the consequence of the deficiency or inadequacy of religious certainty, of confidence in ultimate truth. Or the other side, religious certainty was the mother of intolerance, in their view. How to predict someone who's going to be intolerant? Look at it and see how certain they are of what they believe. And that's the way to see how it was a short step between I am certain and you must obey me. The Enlightenment inheritance has come down very hard into our world with just these very ideas. That religious peace and well-being and cooperation with each other is built not on our belief, but on the strength of our doubts, we're told. Our inability to be sure about God, who God is at all. Religious tolerance is possible only if we recognize the lack of intellectual foundation under our faith. This is Enlightenment speaking, not me speaking. Or with deep cynicism, the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr said that modern tolerance was possible only with the decay of religious conviction. Religious humility is much more rare than religious indifference. It's indifference that makes room for tolerance. You see, it's either indifference or doubt makes tolerance possible. Phew! We can be tolerant with each other because we all know nobody really knows what's going on. So we just admit that we don't know what's going on, and then we're kind to each other as a result. So the image that you get out of from the Enlightenment about confidence and truth and tolerance is basically just imagine a seesaw. It's a zero sum. So that the heavier that certainty is, the lighter tolerance will be, the less tolerance there'll be. The more tolerance there'll be, the less certainty there'll be. They're on opposite ends of a seesaw. And to be fair, as you look around, there seem to be a lot of examples of this that seem to bear this out. Think of the Taliban, say, and the level of religious certainty that the the Taliban has. Or think of the suicide bombers that are in our news. Wow, unless these guys are drugged, they have a high level of certainty to go and do what they're doing. As well as some hardcore Christian fundamentalists who have a level of certainty that seems to stand behind a warrior mentality in the culture wars. There can be a relationship, there's no question about it. But I will be arguing that there's not a necessary relationship there. Remember the Puritan views of Milton and Owen, whose confidence in the truth led them to preach, because they were so confident in the truth, that led them to preach tolerance. And they would run it the other way, that we're so confident in the truth that that's why we dare to have tolerance. And we think tolerance will flower because we believe the truth is the truth. Okay, interaction of truth and tolerance in the U.S. I'm going to take a metaphor used by a Christian sociologist called Stan Gady, it was just sort of fun to play with it, or the way he played with it, as if there was a sort of a romantic relationship between confidence in truth and toleration in American history. And he emphasizes very much that tolerance in this country, sort of coming together in the First Amendment, was not the result of people developing ideas about what a wonderful thing tolerance was the necessity. Here are all these people thrown in together, living side by side, believing in different things. How in the world are we going to get along? I mean, how are people in Virginia who are Episcopalians to get along with people in Maryland who are Catholics, with people in Massachusetts who are Congregational, or whatever, and how is it going to work out? But they had to. I mean, like by the time of the Revolution, Franklin's famous phrase, if we don't hang together, we're going to hang separately. the Revolution forced a unity, but that unity had been developing all along. It never would have just come as under force of the Revolution. It had been building for more than 100 years. But it's the practical reality came before the theory. But the romance, you start the 1600s, and it's as if tolerance was a sort of a 16-year-old girl who was much too young to ever date a 40-year-old man who is truth, who is bound in authority and so on, in religious truth is solid, going back to Europe and national churches, and everything has to be fixed and solid and so on. So she was much too young. But as the 1600s went on and the 1700s started, she grows up and she begins to relate more to truth. So they begin to relate, and in through the 1700s, you begin to have a real relationship developing, coming together in some sort of a marriage. I think he would say by the Revolution and the Constitution, not a marriage of convenience to some extent, some marriage of convenience, but of mutual respect at least. The First Amendment, I think, is a very important piece in this, a real achievement. Just the two clauses I'm thinking of, the clause prohibiting the federal government from establishing any one religion, and also guaranteeing the free exercise of religion. Those two clauses, of which infinite amounts have been written, do give a really... I think a good foundation for religious diversity to function, religious pluralism to function, because what's prohibited is the federal government from favoring any one religion, giving it special benefits, or persecuting any one religion, giving it special aggravation. But the vast moral energy and motivation of religious people could be harnessed because the free exercise of each religion was allowed. And so the religious energy was turned loose rather than chased out or chased away or something like that, that it would have been if only one was allowed. And so it does, I think, a really good job there, although all sorts of things have been done with it. But anyway, I'm not a lawyer, so that's just as well. It allowed each tradition, even to have to express their tradition in a passionate way, and to not have persecution because of it. Gedi's point is that confident truth and tolerance of diversity worked relatively well together for quite a while in American history. So what he's saying here is that you have in this period of American history the seesaw not really applying. You have confidence in truth and tolerance working together in this, he calls it an odd marriage, and showing that the seesaw isn't a necessary paradigm. In the 1800s, tolerance became a more equal partner as freedom became an integral part of American mythology, folklore, and self-identity. Freedom and tolerance are bound together inseparably. De Tocqueville wanders through the United States in 1835, and he writes this amazing book, Democracy in America. And one of the things, which is still, many people say, it's the best book that's ever been written about America. But he reflects on the amazing way in America, the amazing coexistence of religious conviction and tolerance and mutual cooperation, and how somehow it gets along, people get along and make it work. You get to the late 19th century into the 20th century, and the truth member of the marriage starts getting sick and starts getting pushed to the side, starting in maybe the arts and philosophy, coming a great doubts and uncertainty about what could be known about God at all, about the Bible, about theology, about ultimate questions. Some people got excited about this, and this is great, this gives us freedom. Other people were horrified, saying this will give us despair. Both were right. But truth gets pushed aside and given less space and less reliability. And by the second half of the 20th century and into the 21st century, I think you have tolerance and freedom standing tall and truth very much in the background. We'll talk about that much more tomorrow. Truth is so enfeebled that it can speak for freedom and tolerance, but not much on its own. So Gedi's point in this image of the marriage, this odd marriage, is confidence in truth and tolerance are not necessarily opposite ends of the seesaw, but they really worked pretty well in American history for a good chunk of time. As he says, it was no Camelot, but the time when, I think I've got a quote. Yeah, this is a quote from him, which is important given particularly what is going to be coming in these talks. Time when men and women of conviction could live in relative proximity to one another, yet hold on to their commitments with confidence, construct their lives according to those commitments, argue forcefully about their beliefs, have those arguments understood and countered, not with accusations about intolerance, but with counterarguments, and still, on the whole, refrain from using force as the final arbiter. This is Stan Gedi, as a sociologist, looking back on this. He's the one who came up with this odd marriage metaphor. But he's reflecting back on American history and saying there was this time when this was the case. And it's in a book that is very critical of the new tolerance, where people arguing their commitments, their religious commitments, forcefully about their beliefs, have those arguments not countered with counter-arguments, but with accusations of intolerance. What he's saying is that this is, argument and counter-argument is the way it ought to work. This can be very fruitful for all people to argue the issues of religious truth, not tear each other's eyes out over it, but to be able to go back and forth and both learn from each other. I'll be talking a lot about that in the next lectures. It's sad in a way that he sees this as more limited to that period of time. Now you think of how much, when someone asserts their religious convictions, how much the immediate response is, you'll offend somebody. Or you have offended somebody just by what you've said. You've offended me. Or whatever. And so it shuts down serious discussion of the most serious topics. I'll just end with an example of the example of Nathan the Wise. I'm backing up a little bit here into European history, going back in the Enlightenment, because I think some of the changes on truth happened earlier in Europe than in this country. The collapse of truth in Europe really earlier on. Nathan the Wise is a play written by Lessing, the German philosopher Lessing, who lived 1729 to 1781. He wrote it in the late 1700s. It was set, the play, Nathan the Wise, was set in the time of the Crusades. And it's a conversation between a Muslim, a Christian, and a Jew. The Muslim asks the Jew, Nathan, what religion is the truest and the best? So he's going back to the Crusades when people were fighting. He's expressing Enlightenment views of consternation over this. What was the matter with them? And Nathan the Wise is a... Nathan then tells him an elaborate parable. There was a man who had a magic ring which had been passed down to him from generation to generation. Possession of the ring made you loved by God and loved by other people, made you successful in every way, and good and loving. But the man had three sons whom he loved equally. What was he to do when he got old? Because he had promised the ring to each of his three sons. Bad idea. He had a jeweler make two exact copies of the ring and gave each son a ring, though of course only one had magical powers. When he died, the sons argued over who had the real ring, their argument very purposefully mirroring the futility of arguments between Jews, Muslims, and Christians over who's right. I mean, the arguments very carefully were illustrated. I mean, he made it very clear what he was doing here. These arguments are represent these three traditions. None of them had the information they would have needed to know which one was real. So they were stymied. Then they all went to a wise judge, and he told them this. He said, if each of you in truth received his ring straight from his father's hand, let each believe his own to be the true and genuine ring. The brothers were advised then to forget about which is the true ring, the real ring, and to live a life of moral goodness and honor to their father and God, and to show by the way they live that theirs was the true ring. Okay? And this story resonated with people at that point a lot. It was a very popular thing. It expressed a lot of the views that were brewing at that time. That is, nobody knows what's true. Nobody really has a clue about God. It's fruitless and hopeless quest to argue it out. We don't have the equipment to know what is the truth. So forget all our dogmatism and certainty about theological propositions. Let tolerance triumph and just live a good life. So just give a good life and you will have taken the most important thing from all religions anyway. This is all that they're on about. You would have expressed what was important about religion anyway. What matters is not what is true, but what you believe to be true and what you do with it. There's no power that we need to worry about in one ring. The main thing is that we are satisfied with our own faith, however it may or may not correspond to the real truth. The parable also corresponds to what would become a new criterion of religious truth, which is the way to judge religious truth is not in the truth or falsity of any doctrines, but rather in how does it make people live? Does it make people good and nice people? Does it lead followers to do good things in the world as we judge goodness? But there is, I have to sort of push this home, an ironic turn here that we'll be speaking about more tomorrow, and the next lecture particularly. The whole story here that the sons experience is in not knowing which ring is the true ring. They don't know. That's meant to be similar to us not knowing who God is. That's parallel to us. Our pathetic situation of not knowing who God is. The God of Islam, Judaism, or Christianity, or whatever. But the irony is that the minute we've heard this story, we emerge from the story having been told exactly who God is and how we ought to understand him. So, he's talking to us all, supposedly we don't know anything about God, but he's told us actually who this God is and what to believe about him. God is a weak father who feels such a need to be loved by his children that he lies to them with impossible promises. Because he loves them so much, he doesn't want them to be disappointed. That's who God is. That's what we have coming through. And with that sort of God, that would be what he does would be the consequence. It would be a natural following from this. The point's meant to be that we must be tolerant because we can't know which the real ring is or the real God. But having heard the story, now we are on the inside and we do know who God is. We have this inside information that the sons did not have. We do not know nothing about this God. We know a lot about this God and what he has done. We know that he creates false promises to keep his children happy, but in the dark. We know the true status of these true religions, that their various truth claims are bogus, except that they tell their followers to be good and be tolerant of each other. Now, I lay that out because this is really starting us toward the new tolerance that we'll be talking about tomorrow. This gets us moving toward a very different view of how we understand God and the problem of negotiating tolerance and where our tolerance comes from. So, just winding this up, I wanted to tell a bit of the story of the development of religious tolerance. It could be much fascinating, much more amplified story if I had the history to do it, and we all had the time to do it. But it's a story really about how people have lived with their differences, how Christian people have lived with their differences, living close to people with very different religious perspectives around them. Through much of this time, it was Christendom that was almost entirely a Christian monopoly from the late Middle Ages on through much of the early modern time of history, when all of Europe was not just Christian but Roman Catholic. Issues were more with Judaism and Islam of those outside, but those were fairly well, I don't dare get into where those stories lead. After the Reformation, you have intra-Christian diversity, which was a major problem because it was such a sharp contrast with what had gone before. And especially since it overlapped with the empire building and land grabbing of the major empires. It also is a story that is important in this country, because I think there's a certain way we should appreciate and be grateful for and learn about this whole development in our own country. Not that it was perfect at all, but it was a daring experiment in many ways, and one that I think has worked out. I think it's worked out very well. Some people I respect would say that one of the reasons, say, Protestant Christianity has thrived in the U.S., or wait, just say Christianity has thrived in the U.S. and it has been drying up in Europe for the last 100 years, has to do with exactly the religious freedom that we have here, the absence of state of national churches, etc. My Labrie colleagues in Europe don't agree with me on this, but the discussion is still on. So I'll end there, and next time we'll look at the new tolerance. That'll be at 9:30 in the morning, but this evening we can have some discussion. So I'll stop now and turn it over to anybody. Our discussions run that if anyone needs to leave, just go right ahead. I'll stay and talk for as long as anybody has energy to talk. Yes.
So if you were to, back in your story with the analogy of truth and tolerance, at one point you interjected truth. At this point, got sick. Right?
Yeah.
So I'm just curious about your personal opinion. If you had to make a pie chart of all the things that contributed to truth getting sick, what would those pieces of the pie be, and how big of a pie piece would evolutionary theory be?
Yeah, I really would back away from you paying any attention to what my answer might be. I can throw out some thoughts. I will use the image that I will use tomorrow of different tributaries coming into this demise of truth. A tributary being a river that flows into a bigger river that flows into a bigger river and so forth. Yeah, I think, well, let me just do big chunk, because I could go on for all night. It's just going on for one thing and another. There's all sorts of areas that the church has done it to itself. The loss of sense of authority of the Bible. Scott has written a fascinating book that talks about one of the fastest intellectual revolutions he knows of, which is he would put around 1870, before which in this country you'd need a pretty good reason why not to believe in the God of the Bible, after which you'd need a pretty good reason why to believe the God of the Bible. Now, obviously, it doesn't happen like a line like that, but some sort of a tilt happens in 1870. I would say that's in the academic world. The population as a whole, it's much later and much more diffuse and much more confusing and so on. But something like that happened. Civil War had to do with it. The carnage and the seeming senselessness of that much death in everybody's presence. A huge factor which he raises was that the way he tells the story, a huge amount of ideas came from Boston and Cambridge to the rest of the country that were terrible ideas, that were very, very destructive ideas, came from greater Boston. As far as Concord too, yes, that's right. But through them, German criticism of the Bible came. Christians within the church started to spread the ideas of higher criticism, higher critical views of the Bible. And that was a huge shock to people who trusted the Bible. If the church won't defend the Bible, where are we? The church says we can understand the Bible just as a human book, basically. Where are we? He puts huge emphasis there in terms of the loss of faith within the church. You have, I think, weaker the church itself. It's very hard to put. In the Second Great Awakening and times after this, put a huge emphasis on you meet God on the mountaintop, and God is known very personally, very intensely, and you don't need to think much about what's going on. You don't need much theology. You don't need to worry about ideas that are going on around you. There was a real anti-intellectualism and unwillingness to engage in the growing rationalism that was happening in the universities and all over the place. So the church, I think, was tying itself up in the late 19th century in a way that's very important, and wasn't able to deal with the evolutionary theory or anything like that. So I think that's... Well, it's interesting that... There's a book here, it's a really interesting book somewhere, called Dismissing God, talking about fiction writers, American fiction writers who dismissed God, who lost faith in God. And many, many of them, mainly 19th century, early 20th century, many of them, it was because of evil. It was because of, if not the Civil War, the First World War, or just seeing evil in a radical way. Now, he and others wonder, why then? Christians have lived through the bubonic plague when a third of Europe died right on in their own houses. Lewis says things like that, and all the medical procedures and so on, before there was chloroform and people, any anesthesia at all, and people still believed in a good God.
Yeah.
But somehow by the late 19th century we hit evil, and we do it with a weakened faith, is what I would argue. We do it with a very weakened idea of providence, and sure enough, with a weakened idea of God, God isn't big enough to help us understand the nature of evil, and so we collapse. Those are big things. I could go on much too long, but yes.
Matthew 13. The kingdom of heaven may be compared to a man who sowed good seed in his field. But while his men were sleeping, his enemy came and sowed weeds among the wheat and went away. So when the plants came up and bore grain, then the weeds appeared also. And the servants of the master of the house came and said to him, Master, did you not sow good seed in your field? How then does it have weeds? He said to them, An enemy has done this. So the servants said to him, Then do you want us to go and gather them? But he said, No, lest in gathering the weeds you root up the wheat along with them. Let both grow together until the harvest, and at harvest time I will tell the reapers, Gather the weeds first, and bind them in bundles to be burned, but gather the wheat into my barn. So, I'm thinking, like, God is tolerant towards us right now. Mm-hmm. And there is a judgment day when Jesus will return, and there won't be, you know, there will be the wheat and the weeds, and... I mean, like, religious intolerance was practiced on Jesus' body on the cross.
Mm-hmm.
So why should we, as followers, expect any different mm-hmm. against like persecution and suffering. And I think our job now, if we know Jesus, is to tell people who don't know him yet about who he is, and so that when judgment comes, they can be gathered into his arms mm-hmm. and not be bound in bundles and burned.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of C.S. Lewis's quote in Screwtape Letter, where the gentlest road to hell is just the slow descent, mm-hmm. imperceptible. I just felt like fire.
Sure. No, I get. I'm glad you did, because that's that parable. That parable. I can't imagine that was read by people throughout the church.
Yeah.
Because what he's saying there is something amazing. He says, because what he's talking about is people who think they're doing God a favor, weeding God's enemies out of the world. We'll get these awful people who are God's enemies, we'll get them out of the world. And what Jesus is saying, this is Jesus' non-confidence vote in the church, mm-hmm. that the church knows the difference. The force of that parable is that we don't know the difference between who God will judge, who God will not judge, who God wants in the world. It's not our job. And yet that's what the church did, mm-hmm. thinking they were being faithful. And so that parable to me is hugely important on this issue of legal tolerance. It means sit down and, as you say, live, preach the gospel, but don't even think about being the one who can serve God by weeding people out of the world, because that's I just can't imagine what people were thinking. I mean, they were living in the Old Testament, and they would follow Joshua, and you just look at some of the attitudes toward. Of the early settlers here toward Native Americans, and they were capturing Canaan, and it was like they somehow were appointed as if God had told them to wipe out the Native Americans.
Jonathan Edwards witnessed the Native Americans.
He witnessed to them. That's right, which is great. But he didn't. He was very much against the what was done to them, even within his lifetime. So that parable is a wonderful parable, seems to me, on just the stance the church should have in the whole church age, which is not to have anything to do with these military maneuvers of removing people from the world. So, yeah, I'm glad you read that, because that's yes.
Are you ready for a question?
Sure. we'll see.
So in regards to political tolerance, I sort of have these delusions of grandeur in my head where I like pretend that I'm like leading or like dictator in chief or whatever. And I can sort of craft situations where it would be impossible for the onlooker to determine whether I was politically intolerant. Or whether I was just stamping out rebellion or something like that. And I'm sure you can think of a situation where that might blur the line between religious intolerance and political maneuvers or power. Does that make sense? Like, how can you always separate the two so distinctly? Like, hasn't there been times when political power looked religious and yet it was just looking out for the good of the people, or vice versa.
Or advancing the economy. Sure. Yeah, I think that's always confusion. There's always danger of mixed motivations and even doing something that's right to do, your motivations might be mixed in doing it, but it is right to do nonetheless. But, I mean, without you giving me a specific example, I can just think of enormous numbers of people confused and in agony over tensions of making, say, people really trying to make a righteous decision, trying to be just, trying to stand before God and make a, I mean, we do all the time. So having a business and employing people, you you have to make agonizing decisions where you feel in tension between what is the right thing to do, what isn't the right thing to do, what's just, what's not just.
What is religious or not? Like if a country says we cannot accept any immigrants or refugees, or if we say all these people like cannot practice their religious beliefs because it infringes upon the freedom or safety of this group of people living here, that seems to me as like a, you could either call it religious tolerance if you're on the bad end of it, or you could call it like intolerance on the other end of it because you're for protection or whatever you want. It doesn't seem to me like a blurry line.
Yeah, well, the question of refugees right now in all our countries, much more in Europe, obviously, because we're pretty stingy about offering anyone much of anything in this country so far. But I think there's very, very real issues, and it's not an easy answer at all. It isn't just open the doors and let everybody come in. I think of people in Hungary, and they've been under Islam before, and they don't want, you know, a growing Islamic population, maybe for some good reasons, maybe for some not so good reasons. But
I guess my point is that isn't there an appropriate time for a country to be what we might call religiously intolerant because of the safety of its people?
Sure, I think so. And I mean, it's what we might call is a very loose thing, but I mean, for example, I've thought of this. We have a good friend who's been in the small city government in Holland, a guy who's working in the Brie, actually, and there, he's in Utrecht, and I think 7% of Utrecht, this was a couple of years ago, is Muslim. 35% of the school system is Muslim. He's like, whoa, what's happening there? And are their doors just open for everybody to come? They, I think, struggle with saying we have a culture that is really, that we value, that has a certain shape to it. We think that is not protecting that is not an unrighteous thing to do, but is a valuable thing to do to protect our people and the values that have made it what they are. We need to gear immigration in some way to with those two values: one, helping people in trouble who are homeless, and then two, yet protecting the nature of the culture that we've developed. And for example, in Holland, they require anyone who stays has got to learn Dutch. So, and they're trying to spread people around and not have sort of enclaves. They're doing all sorts of very imaginative things with the Muslim population, trying to make them blend in more to the population of Holland. I mean, what's the deal? Maybe some of you know more about this, but just this town near here, south of Worcester, about a Muslim graveyard?
Dudley,
yeah. I'm not sure quite what the issue is there, but I think that Muslims don't... We require someone to be buried in a concrete enclosure in their casket, that their casket goes into, because as they decompose, that will limit the runoff, as it were, of whatever they may result from their body. And that's one of the reasons that people don't want to have, just let them do whatever kind of graveyard they want to do there. There may be other issues there. I've heard that one. There may be other ones also. But I mean, I think we have a right to have to maintain certain health standards. And if it violates their religious tolerance, they have come here, I want to say. And they're not at liberty to violate our health standards by their religious standards. Or on a more, much more extreme thing, I mean, you have some people saying in England, where you have huge areas of Muslim populations within that, suggesting that they should permit honor killings because that's part of the Muslim custom. And who are we to say that customs are wrong? I want to say, whoa, hold everything. No, I have no problem cutting off their religious freedom.
That's a religious decision.
What?
But that's a religious decision. Sorry, I could go all night. I'm shut up.
No, it's
yeah, but the legal terms that a legal decision.
No, it's a yeah, it's
murder. Yeah, against the law.
And that is backed by the religious commitments here, but it's taking someone's life is a pretty big, big and important thing. In this country, I don't think it would happen now, but the Supreme Court made in the late 19th century, made polygamy illegal. Now that's restricting religious freedom. But the argument was that the First Amendment, we want to guarantee free exercise of religion, but not when it goes against the common good. And like the Supreme Court determined was that would go against the common goods enough so that we will not. Same thing with Jehovah's Witnesses not allowing their kids to get a blood transfusion. The Supreme Court trumped their religious scruple there and said no, even a parent of a Jehovah's Witness child is not allowed to prevent blood transfusion from
save the life of the child.
Yeah. So there's all sorts of things, and that's a moral decision taken politically that cuts across a religious conviction, which I think we must do. I have no problem with that. I may have a problem with how those decisions have gone and are going to go, I think that's the sort of thing a government must be free to do, because people in the name of religion are kind of come up with all kinds of wacky things that would be very really against the common good.
Well, Jim Jones, the Jim Jones religion.
Yeah, well, he didn't try to do that here.
I have two questions. I hope they're quick.
One at a time.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I will.
Okay.
they're just questions on history, like things that I'm not sure of. So you had said that it was mostly Ferdinand and Isabella from the Inquisition. It was more the Spanish Inquisition than the Church Inquisition.
Yeah.
From
Spain.
How tied were they to the Church? Because you hear of Galileo going for the Inquisition and everything like that. How tied were those two organizations? And if the Church was tied into the Inquisition, what was their justification for allowing the Inquisition? How did they come to that doctrine that was okay? Or did they? Or was it more political?
I really don't know how it was justified. It was a mixture of political and church throughout. It wasn't just political. I may have given the wrong impression. but I do know the Pope was pulling against Ferdinand and Isabella and to back off on it. I think it was just, listen, this is life and death. This is heaven and hell. We need to intervene and prevent evil from happening. The stakes are so high that justifies us doing all sorts of extreme measures. I can't footnote all that, and it would be very likely much more sophisticated than that and complex than that. So I don't dare.
That's okay.
Just throw out guesses.
Okay. I was thinking more with them compelling someone to believe in Christianity more than I was thinking, for the common good. Thinking like if you have to lose before the Inquisition, convert or die.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether Jewish people were submitted to it or not, or aberrant Christians more. To the Inquisition? Yeah.
at first they were told it doesn't matter, say whatever you want to say. Like, they got absolved from it later. But then they came back and said, if you converted, then you have to be, you can't be Jewish now. So it was, the coin kept flipping on them, depending on who was in charge.
Yeah, well, it's certainly not a high point.
No, absolutely not.
Did you have another question?
Yeah, and I don't know if that was a better higher point. But, okay, so it's really interesting because I'm thinking about the Puritans first going to Holland and then coming here. And you always kind of learn it in this convoluted way that they just came to America for religious freedom. And you keep thinking, well, didn't they have religious freedom in Holland? And then why would they leave there? Just, you know, it was morally corrupt, so they had to go and have religious freedom somewhere else. But it seems like when they come here, they don't want religious freedom at all. They want their own religion because, like you said, they kicked out Roger Williams. So,
well, it never was for religious freedom for everybody, for religious toleration. Mm-hmm. They wanted religious freedom for themselves, which they were to set up their whole city on a hill, and which they didn't have that freedom in Holland. They weren't able to have a colony in Holland. They were given space by the grace of Holland, but they wanted to be able to set up their whole deal themselves and run a congregational theocracy.
So it's kind of a misnomer when we say the Pilgrims came here for religious freedom.
Well, freedom for themselves, but no one was talking toleration then.
Right.
So toleration would be an anomaly, an anachronism.
Right.
If you thought they were coming for religious toleration, it would be a time warp, because no one was thinking about that then. But it was everybody wanted to do their own thing, and of course, you have to. Somebody doesn't toe the line, you chuck them out, and they threw quite a few people out of Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And it was sort of a sad story. But yeah, he was thrown out of here in the middle of a snowstorm. He was rescued by some Native Americans.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, he may not have thrown out, but he knew it was coming and left. I don't know. It was a complicated story.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't a pretty time. Yeah, any other things we'd like to... Go ahead.
This is a question, just an observation. At the very beginning, when you were talking about the original tolerance being personal and legal, I just find that interesting when you think about God and Scripture as, called delight in the law of the Lord. But we can only really know delight in the law if we've experienced the personal God. And then thinking about that more in a broader context throughout history, even just the different examples of the theocracy, yearning for both that reality of God's love and God's law, fullness of that we sometimes experience, that we experience when we recognize Christ as Lord and say, we recognize the significance of that we can, I don't know if any of this is really good, but, things that we tolerance living within a society today, being able to reconcile sometimes difficult political decisions or moral decisions. Sometimes being able to reflect back on original tolerance or being tuned with that personal and that legal aspect of God's law and God's personhood makes it a little bit easier to conceive of how we can practice tolerance. And again, I don't really know if this is making sense. But it was interesting to me when you said those two things. I immediately thought of Scripture
and the how we take the person of God and the law of God, and it really does shape the way that we live and see the world around us. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if I've understood you, which I'm not sure I have, but you have a law, and I mean, even with the law of the land, you have the idea of a lawgiver who is gives the law for the flourishing of the people. The law isn't just no, can't do this, but is that with these laws this people will flourish, and that's the whole. I mean, you look at the original, our founders, and that's what they really wanted. They really were struggling for, and wanted it to last, and they were desperately afraid that it would self-destruct in 10, 15, or 20 years, something like that. And so they used the word perpetuity. It comes up again and again with Washington, with all through the Federalist Papers, they're trying to get it, make it to last. So the normal things that just, they've avidly read Greek and Roman history to look at all the different experiments and why they work. But the idea is that people, you give them laws that are geared to what people are like, and they will flourish, and they will want to obey them for the most part, and that's just what, you know, the law of the Bible is. I mean, it's I'm giving you this new land. These are the laws you've got to keep the land. Mm-hmm. I've taken you out of slavery, giving you this land, and you obey this, and you will flourish in the land if you obey these commands, and you will be able to keep it. Otherwise, you're going to go right back into slavery. Mm-hmm. And if you disobey these laws, because the laws are geared to our humanness. Mm-hmm. So I think the whole thing is very, in the biggest way, similar to the laws of the Bible. They're there for our well-being and for us to flourish. And in the biblical context, though not as a way that we can be saved, as if we can obey them well enough to satisfy God, but they are nonetheless a way to just read through the book of Proverbs, and it's so much how you will prosper if you behave this way. And so that's what good laws are meant to do, of any sort.
I guess even taking that a little bit further, looking at the New Testament, looking at Christ as the fulfillment of the law, and I was thinking about this when I was asking the question about making biblical decisions. Christ said, "It is finished. It is accomplished."
Mm-hmm.
I think so often we forget. We're so often, we especially right now, things going on are really difficult political season. I think sometimes we forget that we are followers of Christ, the significance of Him on the cross saying it's finished,
mm-hmm.
what that really means for the reality of human that we're a part of, when we're trying to fight His battles for Him, that really He has already finished it. Yes, we can do the best to be shaped and formed by that law that He's given us that's now in our hearts, but ultimately, it's fruitless. It's doing something that in some way damages.
I can't pick that up.
I'm thinking of it in the context of talking of the tolerance that people often that you see. I don't think that religious tolerance or tolerance with, as Christians, it has to be giving up on our convictions, but it doesn't have to be the point of cutting away from someone else's. Rather, it should, in some ways, give space for life, give space for growth, give space for some sort of understanding of mutual ground inside, so that you can appreciate the personhood of leader and contaminant without necessarily agreeing with their role.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I think that's true.
That's what I was trying to tie back.
Good. We'll try and get at that tomorrow afternoon. Any other things to kick around?
Yeah. I think I want to say just the time of that is almost sort of to lock him. It's almost that I think you quoted something about like religious certainty is antithetical to tolerance. Like there's some people that suggested yeah. that. Where ultimately, the more confident you are in the truth, the more ability you have to allow other people to reach that conclusion on their own.
That's right. And the more you can stand here in the flack. From reasons they don't believe, and the more confident you are yourself, the less you're hassled by listening to someone tell you why they're not a Christian, and not
feel threatened.
Freak out, yeah, and not be threatened by it. So that's a, to me a wonderful thing. So a certain way of apologetics is very helpful in our be able to relate to people, to not be intimidated or whatever by with all the stuff they throw at us. So I think it's very much a question of confidence, and I think that's what Owen and Milton were arguing for, really. The more secure you are in your own faith, the more you can put up with living close to people who completely disagree with you. Which is, and as well as enjoy relating to them and enjoy going back and forth with them. Yeah.
Okay, this might be a totally crazy question again, but is there any way to return to that society of that quote that you put up there? Where you can argue
and have counter
arguments. And have counter arguments. That's what I would like, the counter arguments. The ability to express any of those things that just kind of, I don't care and I'm offended, you know. It seems like we've really lost that as a society, and it just seems like there's never any going back.
Yeah.
It's just really sad to me.
We tried to do this as a brief.
Sure.
Sure.
I'm happy to hear that.
It's not that no one's ever lost their temper here, or anything like that, or lost their cool, or whatever. But this is certainly what we aim at.
But it seems like in that quote, general society was just like that.
Yeah.
It wasn't a little bubble.
Right. Yeah. And, I mean, I love what you're doing. I'm just wondering, as a society, especially with all the distractions of technology that we have now, is there any hope ever?
I think there's got to be. Because, I mean, I think that what he's talking about there is something one can find in a relationship to a single person with a bit of time and energy.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not as if we have to come into a different sort of a social space or something like that.
So you build it one relationship at a time.
Well, maybe, but I mean, you see it with one, and other people can be drawn into it. I mean, so it's not, but you maybe to start once. I mean, we're not alone. There's a fascinating book called The End of Education, which is meant to be both things. They're both uses of ends. By a guy, a Yale law professor. Are you familiar with him?
Yeah.
Oh, you? Yeah. Well, he's not a Christian, very consciously not a Christian, but he's just grieving that this doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he wants it to happen. He makes it happen in his classrooms as much as he can. But I think, yes, that's great, you know, but his sensitivities are in the same place. He wants to be able to discuss God or know God or whatever. And these questions are gone in the classroom, mm-hmm. and for the most part, because you can't offend anybody. But there's someone not a Christian at all and is struggling for it. I love Chesterton's saying, he loves a good argument. A good argument is just wonderful. Because every once in a while, a quarrel breaks out. Then you have to stop and undo it and start again. Now, I know what he means. I mean, he was so unbelievably funny. And no one could get very angry with him for any length of time at all. But he loved to trade ideas and go back and forth. And I can imagine he would be tremendously skilled at having... I mean, he would go for these long walks through London. He was good friends with George Bernard Shaw, who is totally on the other end of the pole philosophically. But George Bernard Shaw was about 6'6", and Chesterton was about, I guess, 6 feet high, almost 6 feet wide. And they would stride through London, shouting and laughing with each other for, you know, miles, and they would be seen shouting and laughing and gesticulating as they went, having an absolute blast. You know, you just wish they had a recorder or something to see what they would have said to each other. Mm-hmm. But I mean, there's got to be something actually quite accessible if we try in that, I think. Yeah, Ben.
I'm wondering, just particularly with something Kim said about how often intolerance maybe is connected to fear more than it is to confidence. Mm-hmm. I love the John Owen quote and the Milton quote, the concept that actually we can have a true conviction that would lead us to more tolerance because we're confident enough in the truth that it can stand up to scrutiny out there without me forcing you to adhere to anything. I think the example is the opposite of that that we often see is young people growing up who within the church who have doubts that grow or questions that they have about their faith, and when they try to articulate them, they're met with, have more faith, or it's not okay to ask that. And the overall impression that many of these young people have is that my church, my parents, my home, whatever, are just afraid of these questions because their faith isn't strong enough to stand up to them. Mm-hmm. So it's a fear-based reaction rather than, that's a good question, let's talk about it. If this is really the truth, then perhaps the truth can stand up to this, to scrutiny. But that's such a sad thing, I think, that so many people are discouraged from that. People who are still Christians within the faith asking questions and are discouraged because of a fear-based kind of reaction, which just undermines everybody's confidence that this is about reality. Mm-hmm. If it's an atmosphere that we're just pretending something here, and you better not poke holes in it. Yeah. And, anyway, I love the
Milton. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. I mean, and so often, I mean, one of our great grievances in Madrid is what they come with is sometimes is doubt has been illegal itself. Doubt illegal. Mm-hmm. Doubt itself has been illegal. Has been just so not done that doubt is buried and stuffed. And so it takes ages to get out the things that they don't believe in that really don't, because it's so unsafe. Mm-hmm. Or it's been treated as so unsafe, which is just the best way to empower doubt, to like really do a number on you. dear. Yes, Danny.
So, kind of continuing on Ben's thoughts, where did that cycle of fear and doubt begin? Like, if we're like kind of thinking about like going back to that society, that the ideal society of having arguments and kind of arguments and being okay with that, like poking holes and like or attention to, and being like alright with being vulnerable and talking about what we believe and being convicted, like where did that break down for like, the church, like as a whole? You know, like obviously it wasn't like it was probably over time, but like why do we have that fear of doubt now?
I never could give you a complete idea, but it's part of the whole thing that faith is between you and God. It's a very special and precious thing. It sort of happens to you, and you can't really intellectualize it at all. You can't really not intellectualizing it, that's not the real way. You can't even ask about it, you can't even think about it very much, it just happens to you. And if it doesn't, you just need to pray more, because then maybe it will happen to you. And it just so narrows and limits Christian experience to something very, very humanly narrow.
Do you think it's non-rational?
Yeah, I mean it's very threatened by rational arguments and rational and then of course when it's exposed to someone who's throwing flack at one's faith, then that's very fearful. I think it's just not being at home with getting things on the table. But where that starts, I mean, I think it's come more through from the late 19th century. Again, it's the same period of time of after the Second Great Awakening of seeing your experience with God being on the mountaintop, and then you have this very special and precious experience of God, but that doesn't connect to the rest of life very much, and asking how it might is threatening, I don't know.
Don't you think it extends into today now just because of laziness? Like, I don't want to do a lot of work to find those answers, so just believe.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, but it is made into a virtue. The laziness is lifted up to be a
right.
virtue.
You get a double a win-win.
Yeah,
I can avoid work and I can look more home.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Good.
Oh, it was related to what you were saying. So, do you think fear and lack of certainty is part of that fuel of a new tolerance on their side? Like, because they're not extremely certain in their answers, and you're not exactly sure that your worldview can handle all of the questions. So if we a fear behind all of that. So that's why we shouldn't really discuss it, because then some of those things might become exposed.
I think that could be. I'm not sure how that connects with what I've called the new tolerance, or what you're connecting it.
Well, no, I was saying, you know, how you can't be intolerant of. How do I want to word that? The new tolerance is you must agree with us completely, right? Mm-hmm. Is what you're saying. It's kind of a beating in. It's not just accepting you. It's accepting you and all your ideas.
Well, it's accepting that I don't want to give my whole
lecture.
Sorry,
let me
back this question.
New tolerance is that you can affirm everything that everybody believes.
But if I do that, then I don't really have to analyze what you believe. That's what I'm saying. Is there a fear behind that if you start analyzing everything everyone believes instead of just, you know, it's easier, it's a whole lot easier just to say, oh, I guess it's all right somehow, than it is. And if we start digging, like, too deep, then they'll have to be able to defend what their positions are, too. And so is there a fear behind that? Is kind of what I'm, is that his question?
It can be. That wouldn't be true of everyone at all, because I think a lot of times there's a fascination in the diversity of religious options out there, and people love to study them, love to look at them and see the richness of them and so on, but see them within a certain paradigm. The secret is that they don't exclude any other religious beliefs. When it excludes another religious belief, then you've got trouble.
Mm-hmm.
The new tolerance is committed to non-exclusion. And we'll be talking about that tomorrow.
Okay. Sorry.
Yeah, Kayla.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, in addition to, I think, you know, some kids throw up the church and the questions not being allowed or answered, I would also suggest that I think these doubts and questions also come along because I think typically you're growing up in a homogenous environment, whether it be ethnically, socioeconomically, and then when you grow up and experience new things outside of the bubble that you've been living in, you see, wow, I didn't know that was a question, or this was an issue. And then they answer kind of what you suggested back there, what brought this, you know, crash of truth. And it's more ideas are out there that you have to defend against. If you don't know, you know they exist. I think you have a hard time dealing with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's certainly true. I'm going to talk about that in the afternoon tomorrow just a huge problem we've got is isolation because we're so tribal.
Yeah.
We've been so into a tribe and this guy, interesting guy, a law professor, has written a new book called John and Oz, who's used this term, which I think is really good. He says, particularly the internet enables us to live in an echo chamber. In other words, all you get is the echo back from your own words, your own thoughts. It all comes back. And you don't ever need to be exposed to anything that isn't comfortable for you, that isn't an affirmation of what you already believe. That's, we didn't need the internet to do that, but the internet really helps us do that if we use it in service of that. And that's brutal. I've been railing against tribal Christianity for years now. But it's an ingrownness. It's a circle of wagons. It's a quarantined world, which is just behind all of this stuff.
Yeah.
Yes, many other things.
It's very powerful because within that tribal Christianity, all the many tribes that there are, you know, as children are raised in that, they're told that the other tribe is wrong. You know, we're the ones who do it the right way. They're doing it the wrong way. Don't follow that way. Don't go that way. Just
don't even look at them.
Don't even look at them. Don't consider it. Don't read anything about it. Don't think about it.
Yeah.
And very, very powerful.
Those people outside are not Christians. They're stupid and bad.
Right.
Yeah.
It's the fear. It's a fear. Because if you're a part of a tribe that believes something so fiercely, so strongly, your entire existence depends on that belief.
Mm-hmm.
And so if something threatens that, that's threatening your entire existence, your entire belief system. And that is just, that's overwhelming for people that have a faith belief that's so strong.
Yep.
It's just overwhelming.
Yeah, that's right, and yet we, it's a real challenge to know how, I mean, this is the church, these are people who are the people of God, our brothers and sisters, and what we can do or say. I find when I really walk into it sometimes, I just get dismissed as being secular and liberal and you know, which is, you know, it's still worth a try, it's hard to know how to break through, because it's a social reality that's very, very tight, and it's a kind of social security that I think is very, very destructive.
Destructive to the whole church.
Yep, and it changes the shape and the smell of everything we believe.
Yeah. And it's a non-recognition that the other tribes are even a part of the Christian faith.
Yeah.
You know, they're so far out there.
Yeah.
Can
be. Yeah, Marty?
Well, but then I think what Caleb said is, you know, if a child growing up in that kind of tribe, where they've been told, oh, non-Christians are secular humanists and they're all bad, and people who believe in evolution are bad and they're stupid. And then if you go to a secular college, you meet all kinds of really good people, really smart people, really interesting people who may show more interest in you and your questions than what you found in your tribal Christian bubble.
Right.
And then what do you do? So you have to, hopefully you meet some thoughtful Christians who can help you think through, help you figure out how to negotiate all these conflicting ideas, figure out what we're going to take from what paradigm, where what does it mean to be a Christian? Because you really have, might not have a very good idea of what it means to be a Christian from the tribe with all the added rules and stuff. But,
yes.
We've often had people like that who get off these things. They just meet wonderful people who are teaching evolution and who are awesome people who care about them, interested in them, and aren't mean and bad and stupid. They're actually quite smart.
They're very comfortable, totally open and home.
That's right. They're
hospitable.
Absolutely.
I'd actually be nice to them, the people in their church.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What do you do with that?
Yeah.
Did you have?
Yeah.
I read a book not long ago. I can't remember the title. It's by Christian Smith. Christian sociologist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he interviewed 2,500 teens trying to figure out what they thought about religion and different faiths and all. And in the end, he comes to the conclusion that for most teenagers today, their idea of religion, he calls it moralistic. Moralistic therapeutic deism. So they, you know, they have this idea that there's a golden rule: do unto others, that's what you should do. God exists to help me when I have problems, and if He doesn't come through, then they really left in a quandary. And it's deism, that there isn't a personal God. There's just, you know, God set things in motion and the chips fall where they fall.
Mm-hmm.
It's an emptiness to feel that. And that's most teenagers, he thinks.
In church. From within the church.
Yes.
That's the scary thing. I wonder what... Do you know any idea what the selection of churches is? How he selected the churches, or...
Well, it wasn't just... It was, I mean, Islam. It was across the board.
Oh, I see.
Okay. Yeah, Mormon. He categorizes it. There's a lot of statistics. But yeah, it's just really faith-based in the United States.
Okay, well, I think, as I've understood it, a good number of them in conservative evangelical churches, I think in his work, fall within that category. So, which really means something's really slipping somewhere.
Can we learn how to fix all these problems tomorrow?
In the afternoon.
I know one other person who says you can fix everything, but I'm not that. I'm not going there. Yes, any other things you'd like to?
Bravo, bellissimo.
That's a hard one. I don't like playing it very much.
Good morning.
Yeah, it was
good morning.
I had a couple of
folks.
Danny, I would like to inform you.
Yeah,
that.
No, I don't play it very well.
No, I'm just being.
Thank you.
Another row.